helping students and healthcare professionals not just survive, but thrive with a purpose. This is the CMDA Student Pulse Podcast with your host, Bill Reichart, National Director of CMDA Campus Ministries.
Well, welcome to another episode of CMDA's Student Pulse Podcast. I'm Bill Reichart, National Director for Campus and Community Ministries here at CMDA. And with me today is Elizabeth Murphy. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Bill. Well, happy to be here.
I'm glad you're here. And just to give a little bit of a intro and bio, Elizabeth is an author, speaker, been so for many years, married to her husband, Michael, for over 38 years, four grown boys, four grandkids, which is exciting. We were just talking about what the fun it is to be a grandparent. And we're going to be talking about grief today. And let me set up our conversation a little bit, Elizabeth, to those listening. I think it's important, you know, Elizabeth, as I mentioned in the bio, you're not from the medical world, but you've been inculcated in it because of your husband's pancreatic cancer. And we want to talk about that kind of POV, the point of view of the patient and patient's family, and how these moments within medicine, especially at healthcare, how they affect and impact those who are going through illness, disease, whatever kind of difficulties and challenges, and to kind of give you as a trainee, because we know that most of the listeners, you all are students, residents, some attendings, of course, to be able to hear this perspective. And so, and Elizabeth had given her story and had talked at one of our CMDA chapters up in Wisconsin, and news came down here to the home office that we need to not just hear Elizabeth for ourselves, but to get this message, your story, into the smartphones as many trainees as possible. So, Elizabeth, thank you for taking the time out to spend some time with me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Bill.
So, I don't want to bury the lead. Your husband died about two and a half years ago from pancreatic cancer. Let's just talk a little bit about that journey. When did you and Michael hear about, or even start to learn to discover that there was maybe not something completely right? When did his diagnosis become evident, and how was it disclosed to you?
Well, he had been having a lot of back trouble toward the end of, in the month of December, and gone to some specialists and stuff, and they did an MRI and they found something and they gave him some plans to fix that, but it continued and it got worse. But nobody mentioned anything about CT scans or anything like that, just that one MRI of the spine. And then we went on a trip and he was complaining about abdominal pain and bloating. And he showed me his stomach and I said, "You have a hernia," because I could just see it. And so we went home and they said, "Yeah, it's an incarcerated hernia. It needs to be operated on immediately." So boom, no imaging or anything. And they fixed the hernia. And within 6 weeks, he still wasn't better. He had a lot of side pain. And I was fussing because I thought he got back to work and got back to mowing the lawn and things like that sooner than he should have, but it didn't help. And so he finally went and asked for a CT scan, and they did the CT in the morning and he went to work, just a normal day in July. And he got a phone call at work, no preamble. He was in a meeting and he was a doctor. It was the doctor actually who had done the CT, a family practice doctor. And he said, "You have pancreatic cancer and I'm going to have an oncologist call you." And Mike was like, "I have to go," in the meeting. And he left the meeting and he just got in the car and he called me, and the oncologist called him in the car while he was driving. Never met him, never knew him, never asked any questions. He just said, "I got your CT scan and I want you to know that you have stage 4 metastatic pancreatic cancer. And we could do chemo or we could not do chemo. That will determine," I mean, this is a, he must have said this is a terminal. He said it's curable, but not treatable, but not curable. Well, when you're in that, I understand that's a better way to say terminal, but when you look back on it later, it hurt a little bit. But anyway, he was near hysterical and I happened to call him right after he talked to this doctor, and I could tell by his voice. I said, "What is it?" And he said, "There's something on my pancreas. I'm on my way home." So I waited till he got home and he came screaming in the door. And he just said, I said, "What's," he told me he got the CT. He said, "A doctor called me and told me it's stage four pancreatic cancer." I said, "Who is this doctor?" He had no idea. I mean, he was in such a state and he was driving and he didn't get the information. And so I got on the phone and called the family practice doctor and said, "I need to know who my husband talked to." And I'm sure they broke a rule, but it was kind of important. And I called that doctor and there were no questions. There was nothing. He was just like, "It's stage four metastatic pancreatic cancer. Without treatment, he'll be dead in a month. With treatment, which will be difficult, he'll live 15 to 19 months." And I just sat there. I mean, there's no question. I didn't have any questions. I didn't even know what questions to ask. And he said, "We need to schedule a biopsy right away." Hung up the phone, kind of talked to Mike as much as we could talk about it. One of our children was home, so we told him because he witnessed the whole thing. It happened to be the day the Milwaukee Bucks won the national championship.
Okay.
So it's a lot of in it's hard to forget. And there
Right.
was a lot of enthusiasm going on in our family about that. And boys were planning to go down there. And here we were with this news, and we were just, but anyway, navigated that as best we could. And then this doctor scheduled a biopsy for about 3 or 4 days later. So went and had the biopsy. And when the biopsy, after that, the doctor who did the biopsy, we've still never met the oncologist, and we still haven't had any conversation other than, boom, here's your diagnosis. And the doctor who did the biopsy, Mike said, "Do I have cancer?" And the doctor said, "If you were a betting man, I would say you do." And Mike said, "What is your suggestion?" And he said, "You should get to Froedtert as soon as possible." And Froedtert Hospital is in the medical center here in Milwaukee, and they're world renowned. They have a world-renowned Dr. Evans, who pioneered the Whipple procedure. So he's a very, it's a good place to be if you have pancreatic cancer. So we waited for the results. We tried to get in touch with Froedtert, and in the meantime, our son went down to the Bucks celebration and, of course, came home with COVID because that was part of COVID going on. And when they were going to go down there, I said, "You might as well drink a cup of COVID before you go." And that was true. They all had COVID. So we were exposed. And so the doctors, we couldn't meet with him personally. He said, "This is the original oncologist." He said, I'll talk to you on the phone." And we said, "Okay." So we get COVID tests. We're negative, but we still had to wear the masks and everything. But we're on the phone. He's not in the room with us. And when the Zoom came up or the appointment came up, he had a mask on. So we've never met him. We've never had a conversation with him. We're now talking to him face to face, but on the phone, and he's wearing a mask. And basically, he gave us the same. He said, "Yes, it's pancreatic cancer. It's stage four. It's spread throughout your abdomen. Your liver and kidneys are not yet affected, but your whole lining of your abdominal wall is full of tumor nodes. And this is emergency, so you need treatment right away." And we said, "Well, we'll be going to Froedtert." And he was fine with that and understanding of that, but that was pretty much all he said. He never said, "I'm sorry." He never said, and nothing. I mean, it was like talking to a robot with a mask on. And it was really devastating because to him, it felt like a procedure and we were just a case and a problem to be solved. And to us, it turned our whole world upside down. So it was really a tough way to get such terrible news. And we ended up with a lot of insurance issues, which made things super, super complicated. And I would say that of the most stressful things about the whole thing were the insurance issues. And yet God provided someone from the first hospital that we weren't going to go to. She called me and said, "I don't think you have enough insurance for what you're facing. I think you're going to need some help. And if you need help, call me." And I did. And she was wonderful. And so there was a blessing in our being with that other doctor and that other hospital just for a little bit, was that woman who helped me with the insurance. So we didn't look at it as I mean, it was bad, but it wasn't awful. And then we get to Frederick. And the first appointment we had at Frederick was with medical oncology, I mean, surgical oncology, because we knew about this doctor. And the doctor came in, she immediately sat down. She had a mask on because she didn't have a choice. But she looked us in the eyes closely. So we got a feel for who she was a little bit. She showed us pictures. She explained where the tumors were and why his was different because it was on the tail of or the head of the pancreas, not the tail of the pancreas. I think that's right. Wherever, yeah, it was on the tail of the pancreas. And she explained it, and she explained why there were no surgical options for him. She didn't just say, "I can't help you. You need medical oncology. See ya." She said, she sat down next to my husband, and he was kind of a big guy, and she touched his arm and she said, "You look like a guy who might have played football." And of course, 50 years ago he did. But and she said, "Think of us like a football team. You don't need me right now, and I can't help at the moment, but I'm on your bench. And if and when you need me, I'm available to you." And it was so it was like she stepped out of herself and she sat with us.
Stay with us. More Student Pulse podcast in just a moment.
To how the news was originally broached, and the interactions were much more clinical, matter of fact, depersonalizing this individual. Now, I know COVID kind of amplified some of these challenges,
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah.
but be hard to argue. Maybe somebody might contact me after this podcast drops and explain why you'd be on a Zoom call with a mask, because that did depersonalize it a little bit more. But this individual really took the time to, well, first of all, the appropriate touch, just that contact, and looking eye contact, all of those, the very, very small things, but they seem to, Elizabeth, make a whirlwind of difference. I mean, from your first
They did. And you know, even the doctor with the mask on, he didn't really look at us, even on a Zoom call. You know, I've had telehealth appointments before, and it, like, I'm looking at you right now and you're looking at me. I felt like he was looking all over the room, looking at papers on his desk. You know, he didn't distracted. And I understand that because to him, this was a giant challenge. And I don't know what he was thinking, but it appeared what he was thinking about was Mike's pancreas, not Mike's heart. And I think his job was both if he wanted to do it effectively.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the difference between the first doctor and the second doctor. And the fact that she could sit down and say, "You look like a guy who might have played football," that felt like she paid really close attention to him as a person. Yeah, she was very present.
I think that's a big difference, and certainly the small things too that weren't huge in the economy of things, but they were important yet nevertheless, and noticed the eye contact and the touch and recognizing and building those bridges of communication and connection. All of those things really make a difference. Was that experience with that doctor indicative of what you experienced from that point on?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. And you know, one thing about the two ways the doctors approached it, Both of them took about the same amount of time. It took about the same amount of time for her to do what she did as the time of the Zoom call. And yet the impact was so incredibly different. And I do know there's a lot of pressure on doctors for efficiency these days. I hear that word a lot, and I have doctor friends who tell me that. But it wasn't any less efficient to do it the way she did it. In fact, if anything, it made it more efficient going forward. Because when we would come into the room with the doctors and we would, get to the appointment or get to the hard news, the bad news, it was already a connection the minute we got there. We didn't have to reestablish some sort of connection every time we came and stuff like that. And the one of the things the surgical nurse or the surgical doctor did, the surgeon, was that she said, "What you need is medical oncology, and you need Dr. Mandana Kamgar. And she's very busy, but she happens to be in clinic today. I'm going to go see if I can find her." And so she walked across the hall, and Dr. Kamgar was in her, she was in clinic. So we literally, what could have taken ages to get an appointment, we just walked across the hall. So we left the hospital that day feeling so much more that we were going to be cared for. We couldn't even process the rest of it, but we felt like we were going to be cared for, and that really, really mattered.
That's yeah, and the audience that's listening, these are most of them are in training, and they are striving and seeking to want to be Christ-centered, compassionate, caring physicians, and it's important for them to hear this again, this point of view, because it also illustrates that it didn't take a lot more time for that connection to be established, and there were these small things done. Could have been overlooked, could have been easily, not done, but were done that created a unique connection between you and the physicians and those providing healthcare. And I think this is good for them to hear. Now, was there any doctors that prayed with you all during the course of treatment? Did they ever engage with any more direct spiritual contact?
No.
No. But even with the absence of praying, you still felt a strong connection. There was a sense of caring and compassion.
Well, one of the things that was interesting is Dr. Kamgar, who was the medical oncologist who we worked with until he died, she came in and the first thing she did was sit down. And I've so appreciated that because we were interrupting her day. We were an unexpected appointment with a serious issue that was moving quickly, but we never felt it like we were interrupting her. She sat down. And she did ask, along the way, she asked some questions. And one of the things my husband said to her is, "I pray for you." He said, "We are people of faith, and that's a huge part of how we will navigate this. And at the top of our prayers is you and the team that you'll be working with." And so I think that too
Yeah. Opens
opened
doors.
doors between us.
Well, yes. I mean, not only was she a blessing to you, but you were seeking to be a blessing to her as well. Yeah. And that built obviously a bridge of relationship there and trust. Well, how long was your journey? It seemed like things were moving very quickly from
Well,
diagnosis
they
to,
yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Bill. Diagnosis to the first chemo was 2 weeks. So we didn't really even have time to grasp what was going on. One of the things that I know is super important in the beginning of this process is that you, the patient, have all the information that you need. But it came so quickly and it was so terrifying. Like the first chemo, there was a lot of talk about if the port ever comes. He had to have a pump that he wore home for 48 hours, and then we had to go back to the hospital and remove it. And there was a lot of talk about, if the pump were to come disconnected, this is what could happen. And it was terrifying. Like the chemo would go in your body. Anyway, and I'm sure that's a total reality. But Mike said to her, "How many people have you known that that's ever happened to?" And she said, "None, ever."
okay.
And so it sort of helped us listen better. Like, we have to hear this information and it's really important. So pay attention, but relax.
But it's hard, isn't it? Because you're stunned, you're in shock. and
you're
it's coming,
panicking.
and it's coming at you a mile a minute. I mean, if in terms and vocabulary that you have to all of a sudden become familiar with, and procedures and protocols that are completely new and novel to you. Standard care for those who are, providing it, they do, they go through this time after time, but this is completely brand new. And then you mentioned on top of that, the insurance issues. I mean, this is just a lot of stuff, a lot of weight and pressure coming at you all at once very quickly. How did you and your family bear under that? I mean, how did it affect you and your
I'm
faith?
sorry. Well, I think the thing that we both learned right off the bat was that Christians are not very good comforters to other Christians.
Why do you say that? Yeah.
They're scared too, and I understand that. Oh, my apologies. They're scared too, and I understand that, and they don't know what to say. And I understand that too. And they're uncomfortable and they want to get uncomfortable. But what they don't realize is they can't even imagine how scared you are and how uncomfortable you are. And so, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, I'd love for you to share, were there examples of people who comforted well and help us understand what that would look like if you saw
They
that?
ask questions.
Ah.
They ask questions. You know, they didn't say, "How are you?" Because that's an unanswerable question. One, the best way to phrase that, which I loved so much, was, "What's it like to be you today?" Because that's the other thing about this. We could wake up and have a ter Mike could be in awful shape. And by noon, he felt so much better. So if you only asked us first thing in the morning, the answer would have been terrible. But, or chemo put him down for 4 or 5 days, but as soon as that was over, he went straight back to work. He worked until 2 days before he died. And he did not want anyone to know he was sick, which was hard for me. He was really freaked out about losing his hair, not because he minded being bald, but he didn't want to look like a cancer patient. And he didn't for a long time. Everyone would say, "Gosh, he looks so good for what's going on." And we sat down together and we said at the very beginning of this, "How are we going to navigate this?" We had heard about a case with Matt Chandler, who's a pastor in the Dallas area, who had brain cancer, and they told no one. They didn't tell their congregation. And we heard him talk about that. And he said, "You know, we don't know if that was the right way to do this or not. That's the way we did it."
Okay.
And so I said to Mike, "Do you want to do this publicly or do you want to do this privately?" Because we are part of a large Christian community. We've lived in the same house for 25 years. We went to the same church for 30 years. Our kids went all through the schools. And he said, "If it were up to me, I would go sit in my chair and not take treatment in a month. And in 1 month, this would all be over. But it's not up to me." And because I am a writer and a speaker, he said, "I'm pretty sure we're going to have to do this publicly." And so we determined from the get-go that we were going to talk about what this did for our faith. And we wrote a caring bridge. And I have heard from so many people how they felt like that caring bridge. First of all, they felt more connected to us and they could pray better for us. But they also felt like they were invited in to two people of deep faith, very publicly facing this challenge. And so when you ask how did we bear up against it, part of it is we invited our community in. We invited our community in. And I would write the caring bridge, and then Mike would take it and tell me that I couldn't say this and I couldn't say that because
A little
I could get
editorial
a little snarky.
license.
Yeah, I could get a little snarky. So he would take the snark out of it. But we had an outline that we followed. We talked about the medical, we talked about the spiritual. We talked about what we were reading and listening to, and we talked about prayer requests. And I had more people say, "I'm loving reading the same thing you're reading, even if it's a mystery, or even if it's a this." And so I think that was probably the most helpful thing that people did was follow the caring bridge and come in from that way. But when I say not very helpful, I'm talking more about personal encounters. For example, a lot of what we heard in the beginning was, "But God can do the impossible." And that is a true statement. It's also very unhelpful under the circumstances. When it's something as devastating as and deadly as pancreatic cancer. And it's also a little out of context, because in scripture, God can do the impossible isn't applied in every situation. But as Christians, we tend to look at a hard situation and go, but God can do the impossible. It's more the result of a conversation. And it felt like we weren't seen or heard. You know, you would be having, like people would say to Mike all the time, so what keeps Elizabeth busy? Is she speaking? Is she writing? And he'd say, no, she's taking care of me and it's a full-time job. Or they would say, we're praying for healing, healing, and only healing, which we so appreciated those healing prayers, but how it felt in a way that was really hard to share was that there's a lot of time between here and healing, and there's a lot of really tough and difficult things. And so maybe if healing is what God plans, we would love for that to happen, but we need to stay in the day. Where we are today is all we can really deal with.
Stay with us. More Student Pulse podcast in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bill Griffin, here to tell you about a tremendous resource for Christian healthcare professionals called the Saline Process. This training seminar will give you the capacity and the confidence to address the spiritual needs of your patients within the context of the care you currently provide each day. To learn more and to perhaps host an event in your area, just go to cmda.org/saline. May the Lord use this powerful program to equip you for truly holistic patient care.
And so instead of saying we're praying for healing, healing, and only healing, it goes back to that same question. What's it like to be you today? And how can I pray for that? Healing felt like we were skipping the process and going straight to the end.
Do you think? Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I'm wondering out loud. It almost sounds like there's the people who are attempting to provide the comfort are really wrestling with their own faith in the middle.
I think they are. And I think they're so uncomfortable and they want to be comfortable. And so they say whatever pops into their mind. And I had to learn to understand that and give grace for that, because it was really, really painful. I had one friend actually say to me, God's going to get tired of hearing. So many people are praying for you. God's going to get tired of hearing your name. And I thought, I don't even, you know, it's not true, but you kind of can't help but take it on. Or God must need Mike, another angel, or God needs Mike in heaven. And I would say, you know what? I need Mike. I need Mike. And so things that are accepted, like at the very beginning when you talked about grief not being a topic that is necessarily talked about in the training process for medical professionals, it's not talked about in life in general.
True enough. Yeah.
And one very important thing that we had to learn, which was, this applies to both questions, how did we handle this and why Christians aren't the best comforters for Christians, or that was our experience, is that very early on I heard the phrase, it was an interview, a podcast with a woman whose husband died of colon cancer. And it had happened about 20 years ago. And she was expressing a lot of regret about the way it was she handled it. And she said, what I failed to have was the courage not to fix things. And she was a TV personality and she had lots of contacts and lots of resources. And she traipsed her husband all over the world trying to find a cure for him. And very shortly after, she wrote a note to a relative that said, oh, he has a new chemo and it's going great. Within a few weeks, he collapsed on the bathroom floor and died. And there was no preparation. There was no letters to children. There was no conversation about anything. And she said, I was so busy trying to help him live, I didn't help him die. And very early on, that was a big prayer of ours, was the courage not to fix things. And I think that God answered that through the doctors as well, because like Mike said, I'm thinking I should quit my job. It's time for me to stop working. And the PA who we adored said, if you want to give the most attention you have to your family, I think that might be a great idea. What a beautiful way to say that. Not your death is imminent, not we're out of options, not, you know, you have very little time left, none of that. She just said, if you want to spend the most time with your family, I think that would be a great idea. And to me, that was her giving speaking that with the courage not to fix things. She didn't say yes, she didn't say no. And all along, we got lots of input. And all of the input was really difficult because they didn't ask questions. You know, I got ambushed at the post office by a woman who had heard me speak somewhere. And she said, I heard about your husband's cancer. And my cousin's brother's sister's friend had the same kind of cancer. And they ate vegetables and their cancer's gone. I didn't even know how to respond. I got in the car and cried all the way home because I thought, no even indication of what we might need or what might be helpful to us. But it was, I have some information and I'm giving it to you. And those kind of things were examples to me of people that didn't have the courage not to fix things. And we prayed that for ourselves. We prayed that for our medical team. We prayed that for our friends and family too. Because one of the things that Jesus tells us is in this world, you will have trouble. Troubles, plural, trials and tribulations, plural. And we really worked hard at living well in the trouble and praying that others could do that with us.
Yeah, and it's in those moments that I find that Jesus is encountered so sweetly, because he is a savior. You know, he's acquainted with grief and suffering. He meets us in a very special place in our tears. And to be present, I know, I mean, we're all very, very much cut from the same cloth. I mean, we all want to, we want to skip over the suffering. We want to move, either fix it or move fast through it to the other side. And I know, to be so present and to be able to sit in that, those moments. And I think you've given me the title for this podcast, The Courage Not to Fix Things.
Well, yeah, might be the title of a book I write, so we'll share it.
Okay, fair enough. but that's not instinctive, and it really took a lot of intentionality on your part to be willing to do it, because it's painful. It's painful. It's got to be so.
But I don't regret any of it. I don't regret. One of the things that happened was when Mike died, someone said, you guys were so knit together. And do you have any regrets? And I said, no, we don't. We really don't. You know, we spent a lot of time with him laying on the couch and me rubbing his head. I mean, and people wanted to know what I was doing. And I didn't really want to say sitting on the couch, rubbing his head, but that's what I did. And we talked about so many things. And we talked a lot about not what God could do, because that really wasn't helpful. We got bad news almost every time we went to the doctor. And unfortunately, with technology, you get blood work and then you wait, at least the way ours worked. We would go to the hospital because we were going to be there for 12 hours between blood work and doctor appointment and then a long chemo infusion and the delays that come with that. So you take the blood test. He get the blood test at 6 or the blood work at 6. And then we don't see the doctor till about 8:30. And so we have 2.5 hours to sit with the results, because they come up on your phone, just like that. And same with a scan. And And I wanted to not read the results until we were with the doctor, but Mike couldn't stand it. He wanted to know the results. And so we would sit with those results by ourselves for a couple of hours before we would see the doctor. And that's when we really prayed. And we would say, you know, Lord, this doesn't make any sense to us. But he was so... I don't remember those as terrible times. I remember them so tenderly, not just because they were tender between the two of us, but because they were so tender with us and God. That's the thing I learned that I wish I had learned way sooner in my life, is that is who the person of Jesus, not what he does. And not even, I mean, you have to know how he behaves and how he treats people and all those things to get to know the person of Jesus. But something specific that came to me, or that was given to me in a book, Matthew 11:28, where he says, Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. I am gentle and humble in heart, and I will give you rest for your soul. It's the only time in all of Scripture Jesus talks about his own heart. God talks about his heart. The disciples talk about his heart. Everybody talks about his heart, but he only says that one thing about his own. And he could have said so many things, but he said he was gentle and humble in heart. And when you are as traumatized and heartbroken and all of the things that we were, what you need is the presence of a very, very gentle Savior. And I asked Mike one time, I said, in all of this process, has anyone told you how much God loves you? And he said, just you. And I thought that was fascinating because lots of people told us what God could do for us and how powerful he was and how, he can do the impossible and he's great and he's strong and all those things, but we didn't really need to hear those things. We needed to know how much he loved us. We didn't need to know about his power. We needed to know about his presence.
You were in our kind of our conversation pre-recording, we were talking a bit and you were very vulnerable and sharing Michael's spiritual journey through this. And there's those powerful moments of trust and prayer, but you mentioned there were serious doubts. I mean, this really took a toll on his faith and perhaps yours as well. But would you tell our audience some of what you told me in that journey and tying in Tim Keller too, that piece, yeah.
Yeah, Tim Keller was diagnosed a little before Mike was, and he lived a little longer than Mike was did. But we followed him closely during this journey, and one of the things that Mike in particular, but me also, I just didn't voice it quite the way he did, was that all of a sudden when it's you, everything's different. I mean, you can speak truth, and he did, and I did. That's part of what we did for our careers. We spoke truth to tons and tons and tons of people, and we were nearby people in terrible illnesses and, tragedies. They just happen. That's life. And I think sometimes as Christians, we like to pretend that's not life. Like what we should actually do is celebrate and welcome if we can and grow through the suffering. And then when life is really good, like we tend to say, uh-oh, when the suffering comes. And in reality, life is more about suffering than it is about not suffering, because grief is everywhere. It's even in things like a brand new baby. It changes your life in a beautiful, wonderful way, but you don't sleep for weeks. And in your lack of sleep, things change. I mean, grief comes everywhere all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, when God tries to remind us that what he will be is with us. We will not be absent of him. But when it's you and it's your reality, doubt comes from everywhere. I know that for the first several weeks that he was ill, he laid on the bed upstairs and sobbed. I'd never heard him cry like that. And he was someone who cried easily, but it was a different kind of crying. And he wrote me journals. They weren't for me, but I have them. And he talked about how scared he was. And he talked about things that he had done in his past so long ago that he was ashamed of. And what would God do with those things? And he said, you can bury him for a long time, but all of a sudden you revisit your life when you're faced with the end of it. And there's some things I'm sorry for. I'm so sorry for. And God says, I'm forgiven, but am I? And what if it's not true? All these things and we knew it was true from his faithful presence to us through our community was amazing and all of those things. But the doubt was very real. And the fear was very real. Sometimes he would say to me, read me the 23rd Psalm and tell me why it matters. And we watched Tim Keller go through the same thing. He wrote an article when he was first diagnosed about his doubt and how when it's you and it's imminent and you see the impact of it on your family and your friends and the people that care for you, it is terrifying. And it's hard to admit that because as a believer, you don't want to admit this was too much for me, but it felt too much. And then as it wasn't long after he said that. We had a long conversation about it. And he used the words, "What if it's not true?" And as he was dying several months later, he had been asleep for a while. And my sister-in-law approached and said, "You know, we're leaving and I want you to know how much I love you." And he opened his eyes. And he went around to all of us in the room and told us how much he loved us. He said, "I love you." And he looked each one of us in the eyes. And then he closed his eyes. And we thought, oh, you know, is that, or the, what, we don't know. We didn't know what to do. We just kind of stood there staring at him. But he opened his eyes again. And then he said, "Wow, wow, wow." Not wow, wow, wow. And this gets misinterpreted. When I hear the story retold, it gets hijacked. It wasn't the wow of, "Oh my gosh, this is so amazing." It was the wow of, "Oh, thank God. Thank you, God, for being everything I thought you would be." He said, "Wow, wow, wow." And then he said, "It's true." And I said, "What's true?" And he said, "All of it." And he swept his hand like this and he said, "All the love. Incredible." And those were his last words. And it took a long time, a couple of years, actually, a year and a half, probably, before I realized that that wasn't just a dying experience. It was this incredible gift, not just to me and to our family, but to believers everywhere, because he connected that to the actual conversation we had about what if it's not true. And he, as he was dying, he made sure that we knew it was true, all of it. And so it wasn't a happy ending because he died, but it was a holy ending in so, so, so many ways.
On the flip side of his death, two and a half years ago, it's been now, correct, Elizabeth? What are some of the reflections, things that, the ways that this has impacted your family, your faith? You've had time, you know, 2.5 years to sit and remember and recall and write or journal. What are some of the takeaways, some reflections as you consider all that God allowed you and Michael to this journey to walk through?
The most important thing I learned is who God is and the person of Jesus Christ. That's the most important thing I learned. And when I encounter someone, I try to say things like, "I don't have words." Or the best encounter I had with someone in the grocery store was, she came and she turned around and she saw me and she put her arms around me and she said, "I know about Mike." And so she took down all the barriers and I got to just relax and be a little bit. I've learned how important it is to have safe people who can just listen. And if you say the wrong thing, they don't, because you're out of your mind. I have no other description for it. I was out of my mind with grief. And I needed grace upon grace upon grace. And sometimes I got it and sometimes I didn't. So I learned who was safe and who wasn't safe. And that's not a commentary on the other person at all. It's just that this is a lot. And I understand that not everybody can handle a lot, but then there are people who are uniquely equipped to hear you and let you sob if that's what you need to sob. I learned that it never goes away. I've heard lots of descriptions for grief. You know, it's like a wave, and that's good. It's true. It's like this, but my favorite is a song that my son sent me. It's called "Grief is Like Glitter." It never goes away because he has four daughters. There's glitter all over his house. He cried for years to confine the glitter to one particular playroom so that it doesn't show up like on his clothes in his closet.
Yes.
And he'll go to a meeting and someone will say, "You have glitter on the side of your face." And
doesn't
he said, "That is the truest thing. Grief is like glitter. Cannot make it go away."
Wow, that's a tremendous word picture. A doctor friend of mine shared, reflecting on the loss of one of his children, and said the most helpful thing is people always attempt to, they wrestle with, what, you know, when I, people see me, what are they going to say? He said the most helpful thing, and I ask you this question, they'd say, Tell me one of the fondest memories, things you miss about, you know, your son. And I'd say, what, Elizabeth, is one of the fondest memories, kind of the things that, one thing that you particularly miss about Michael?
Fond memory. Today, there's new things every day. Even, and there will be all the time. But today, because it's summer, or we're trying to get to summer here in Wisconsin, and the grass is beautiful, and Mike loved the yard so much. And he would take a long time mowing it, like sometimes twice, if it wasn't just perfect the first time. And I would just kind of hang around outside and piddle like I was working in the yard. And I don't know how, but I'm learning. And so right now, the thing that I miss the most is what a great job he did in the yard and how much he loved it. You know, weeding was just his favorite thing. And sometimes he would say, you don't have to pull weeds, just sit and talk to me while I do. And so I did. So today, that's the thing I miss most.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. As we draw our time to a close, Elizabeth, I'd like to point into the direction of, again, the trainees, residents, and students.
Yeah.
And maybe talk directly to them. I mean, it was a mixed bag, you know, good and bad, some clumsy attempts, some better intentioned attempts at coming alongside you as a patient. What would you say to these trainees as they prepare for this vocation and calling of medicine and healthcare? How can they be better Christ-centered, compassionate, caring physicians? As I know they intend and want to be, but as you recognize, the system is designed to do everything but that. It strips away humanity. It makes people units that they, you know, efficiency units that they have to, you know, as many patients as they can get through. And it's very hard to be present, as we talked about earlier. What would you, speak directly to the students as a patient yourself?
Well, two things that I think of right off the bat are, one is, before you even begin a conversation like that very hard first conversation, and you know what, it can be that you have to crown a tooth. To some people, that is so traumatizing that, you know, think about it in those situations too. Remember that they have a heart. Remember that they're not just their pancreas or their tooth or their broken leg or whatever it is. Remember that they have a heart. And really, I know it takes courage and I know it's really hard. Look them in the eye. That'll make them feel seen and heard. Because you do feel like you're kind of just processed through. And one thing I've always appreciated and respected about medicine is that it's called the practice of medicine. And I go to I learned this in the process too, because in a situation like ours, there's a lot they can try, but basically they can't fix it. And so that courage not to fix things, if there's anything you can do to help your patient with that, I would highly recommend it. But also, if you know resources, like one thing our doctor did, and I appreciated it very much, at the very beginning, she said, I want you to go to palliative care. And Mike was like, absolutely not. That's hospice. We're not going to talk about that. And she said, it's not. It's more than that. And I made him go, like dragged him out the door, arms crossed, bad attitude. He sat in front of that doctor. And she said, you don't want to be here, do you? And he said, no, I don't. And she said, then why did you come? He goes, because my wife asked me to and my doctor recommended it. And she said, Dr. Kamgar recommends a lot of people do it, but very few do. But our job is to help people navigate serious illness. And they were so helpful to us. It was like all the guards came down. They couldn't treat us. They couldn't give us a pill or tell us to do this or that. They listened and they gave us suggestions they'd heard from other patients in our same situation. I think they helped the medical professionals with that whole courage not to fix things, because they gave us another place to go for help. So if there's something like that available in your situation, encourage your patients, but give them the information. This isn't hospice. This isn't about death. It's about navigating a serious illness, and that's what you have, and we're here to help you. And if they show even the least sign of being interested in prayer, pray with them. Even if it's as simple as thy will be done. That doesn't even have to, you know, be a formal thing. You can bring that into a conversation, but that's what they need to hear. That word, that one statement, "Thy will be done." You know, you mentioned God, you mentioned church, you mentioned, I want you to know that matters to me too. And thy will be done in this situation for you and for me, because we're going to fight it together.
Thank you, Elizabeth. That's wonderful. Thank you again for taking the time and just opening up your heart and life. And I know you have shared this on multiple times before multiple audiences. I hope and trust that what you shared with me today will have a deep abiding impact in our listeners, our students, as they're again preparing for this holy calling, this vocation of healing. And as we say within CMDA, we want to bring hope and healing through healthcare. And
bring both of those if you can handle this well.
That's right.
Both of those.
Just as a kind of a postscript as we're wrapping up, you're an author and a speaker. Are there places you write? I imagine you've had some reflections that those who are listening might want to dig deeper into. Where can people go?
Well, you know what? The thing I would suggest is they go to Caring Bridge.
Okay.
Because Mike's Caring Bridge, it's Mike Murphy, and his Caring Bridge is still on the Caring Bridge website. And you can access all of the things that we wrote. And then I'm also now part of, I know, Bill, you had to go hunt me down on the internet and you found some old stuff, but I'm now part of, my hair was brown in those pictures too. I'm part of a new website called the Evermore Collective.
Okay.
And I will be posting more there, and my writings, my blogs and things like that will be there at the Evermore Collective.
Let's put those two links, Karen. We'll put those in the show notes so people can access those as well.
Okay. That'd be great.
All right.
That'd be great.
Elizabeth Murphy.
All right.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time. CMDA's Student Pulse podcast is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the organization. CMDA is non-partisan and does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Student Pulse podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members.